today on Life and Faith.
And so it's been difficult. My 3 years in India, hardest 3 years of my life, of all the things I've done, including being in the Marines. But it's 3 years that I wouldn't trade for anything. You couldn't have paid me $1 million a year to do something different, honestly.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. It just gets their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker, nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Now, we seem to say this a lot on Life and Faith these days, but it is important to mention. Today's episode contains material that some listeners would find distressing, and there are parts here that are not appropriate for young children. Just something to be mindful of. Now, unusually, in this episode, we can't tell you who it is we're interviewing. Anonymity was a condition of this conversation, so let me introduce you to Investigator V.
Well, actually, when I was a little kid, my father was a police officer, and he always told me not to become a police officer because they handle all these problems, and they're always the bad guy, and no one's really on their side. So I didn't grow up thinking I would go into investigations or law enforcement.
No.
I always thought I was going to go up and be something like a photojournalist and go out, and I liked photography even as a little kid and documenting things and seeing things. Hmm. So that's kind of how I grew up, with a very adventurous, exploratory kind of mind.
Despite his dad's advice, Investigator V very much went down the justice line. These days, he's working undercover for IJM, International Justice Mission, which works to end global slavery. It's an ambitious task to launch yourself into in semi-retirement, but it kind of makes sense in light of V's career before this.
22 years in law enforcement. Prior to that, 6 years in the U.S. military, in the Marines, as a search and rescue swimmer on a helicopter. And my law enforcement career was 10 years in the California Highway Patrol, like the CHIPS. Yes. And then 12 years, I transferred to the California Department of Justice and spent 12 years there investigating undercover drug operations, manufacturing of illegal drugs, investigating the Mexican mafia and drug organized crime, and in the California and the West Coast. And then 2 years cross-sworn with the FBI doing high-level police corruption cases.
Mm. Okay, well, all of those things sound interesting. Let's go back to the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Tell us about the sort of places you went to. What was that experience like? Was it traumatic or was it lots of fun?
It was traumatic in certain ways, but it was good for me. It was what I needed. You know, I grew up in a family and I didn't have money for college. And the time I enlisted in the Marines, they gave a bonus, or they gave a scholarship, so to speak, funding for college if you were to join. So I enlisted right out of high school. Now, that was against my parents' wishes. They didn't like that idea, but I sensed it was the right thing to do. And it seemed like a logical thing, so I enlisted. And it put me on a path to really learn discipline, to learn how to take care of myself, to learn how to take care of my teammates. I'll tell you, it was a lot of good for me.
As a special agent at the Department of Justice, so that sounds kind of glamorous. We think we know a bit about, you know, organized crime and drug cartels and so on from the movies. Yeah. What do the TV shows and stuff get wrong, or what do they get right about what that world is like?
Well, a lot of the TV shows don't get the whole timeline of crime and how it happens right. For instance, if we go out and we do a big case, they don't understand that we're going to spend the next 2 weeks just doing paperwork.
Yeah.
And, you know,
that doesn't play so well on TV.
No. And God forbid we end up getting in a shooting. And I've been in two fatal shootings. And I mean, you're not back at work the next day. There's a lot of review. There's a lot of oversight. There's a lot of boards that look into it. There's a lot of documentation. So all of that is what the public really doesn't see or understand. And TV just kind of collapses all that and makes it seem like it all just flows so well. And there are challenges and problems all along the way that really nobody wants to hear about.
Because these are incredibly complex systems and cases, I imagine. Do you feel like you saw progress, or is it one of those things where, you know, you cut off one head and three more grow back?
No, we saw lots of progress. I can tell you I worked on a team where we investigated the Mexican mafia manufacturing methamphetamine in California. The first year we started the team, we investigated over 200 methamphetamine labs just in Southern California. And through two more years of work, we had that down to like 20 meth labs. Now, unfortunately, at the same time, other surrounding states, Nevada, Washington, Oregon, they were seeing a rise in those crime. And maybe some people could argue that we're just pushing the crime around. But you know what? When we push it around, when we move it, we exploit its weakness. And so we had a definite impact, and you could see it and you could measure it. And the cost of drugs was getting higher. So that tells us we're having an impact because it's more expensive. It's one of the measurable things.
You're doing some different type of work now, though.
Right.
International Justice Mission. How did you come to be working for them?
I was looking at retiring. In California, they had a time frame where you could retire at age 50 from law enforcement if you had 20 or more years on. And I had 22, so I took that offer. And I was looking into doing some kind of work after retirement. And IJM, who I had no idea who they were, found out about that. And they actually called me out of the blue and began this dialogue about slavery and about oppression and about fighting human trafficking. And honestly, my first reaction was, what slavery? What are you, I don't believe that. The IJM recruiter told me that back then, in 2007, there's 27 million slaves in the world. We were wondering if you would come help us fight them. I instinctively said, no, there's not. How can that be? Honestly, I mean, that number seemed phenomenally high, but I was intrigued, so I listened. And eventually, you know, through discussion and counseling and talking with my wife, who I thought would say no, and eventually joined IJM and went to work. And my first 3 years was in Calcutta, India, and it was still communist, under the communist control of India at the time.
Tell us about that work. What does it involve? What are you trying to do?
I was leading a small team of national staff investigators, Indian staff, trying to train them, mentor them, care for them, and put them in a good position to be able to investigate young girls who are trafficked in the sex industry, in the sex trafficking situations in Kolkata, which has a large amount of them then. It's getting better. But so I'm training them about how to go in the field, how to do surveillance, how to develop informants, and also caring for them emotionally, how to live through this and be strong and be faithful and all of that. And so just leading them in that arena, in that battleground of fighting to find these girls. At the same time, I was building strong relationships with key police officials and government officials so that when we found these young girls, 11, 12 years old, we could go to the police, trusted ones, vetted ones, and we could get them to respond and rescue these girls. The 3 years that we were there, that I was there, we rescued 163 girls. And the three youngest were 5 years old.
Can you tell us a few stories, either successes or failures, to kind of give us a sense of both the work you were doing and also who these people are that you're helping?
I will start off with some of the, I don't know if I'd call them failures, but just some of the things we couldn't succeed on. Because we didn't get every girl out, obviously. There were many times we'd find a girl, say a 13-year-old girl, in desperate need because she's being raped every day, maybe even suicidal, and telling our investigator that I'm going to kill myself if I don't get out of here. And so we would go and organize the police that I knew well, and somewhere down the chain of command, maybe there was a leak. Or maybe there's some corrupt official that found out we were going to this certain brothel to rescue this girl. And for $20, maybe $40, he would leak the information. And so we would all go and organize it and go there, and she wouldn't be there. And now we have to deal with that. Because our investigators have got to know her and understand her plight. And so I have to help the team to process that and to go back out in the field and try again. And so those are some of the, what you'd, I guess you'd call them failures. But they're only failures if we don't go back out. We had a lot of situations very similar to that. And so we just didn't give up. And you know what? There were some ones that we saw and found and have never rescued. But we go back out and there are many more that we did rescue. There was, for example, there's one young girl. And we rescued this girl and two others in late 2007. Very beautiful young girl. She started to respond well. She was doing great in our aftercare facility. She was growing. She was learning. She was very healthy. And after about 2 years of being in the aftercare home, the traffickers who we rescued her from had never stopped looking for her because she was just money to them. And so they found out where she was. They found out that she was in a work release program where a couple hours a day she would go from the aftercare home to work and learn a career so we could make her self-sufficient. And so they sent a young man out to this work release program as well and convinced her that he loved her and that he wanted to marry her and that they could do all these things together. And, you know, a young girl, she's very impressionable. So he convinced her to run away with him. And he actually took her on a train to the other side of India, all the way the other side to Mumbai, where the traffickers then took her, told him to go home, and brought her back into sex trafficking in Mumbai, a city of 22 million people on the other side of the country, thinking that we would never find her. In fact, when we went to the police with all of this, they interrogated the young man who did all this and said, look, I only know the train station in Mumbai where I dropped her off. They paid me 1,000 rupees, and that's all I know. And so the police said, well, we're done. It's impossible. We'll never find her. 22 million people. It's just not going to work. Give up. It's too much time. It's too hard. It's difficult. It's not going to work. You know, as a team, we love this girl, and we weren't willing to give up. And we said, we're not going to give up. And I convinced the police official, let us continue to investigate it. And he did. He said, but you're wasting your time. He said, it's impossible. So we grilled this young man for more and more information. We had a team in Mumbai. We began to feed them pictures of her. They began to look. In 4 months, it took us. We found her. Myself and a couple other investigators flew across the country to Mumbai. We did some surveillance. We confirmed it was her. She was being taken by traffickers from a place where they kept her out every day to these sex parties, establishments. So we were waiting for her to come out, and the police were going to show up, and we were going to re-rescue her again. She came out with a trafficker to get in a rickshaw to go, and the police were not there. So I called the police myself, the police chief in Mumbai. I said, she's leaving with a trafficker, and you're not here. And if we lose her, we may never find her again. And the police chief tells me, okay, I give you the authority to stop that vehicle and take them into custody. He said, I'm 20 minutes away. I said, you understand, I'm not even a citizen of your country. And he said, that's okay, I give you the authority. And I actually just hung up the phone then because I didn't want him to take it back, realizing what he had done. And so as a team, in this huge city, massive people all around, we forced this rickshaw to the side of the road, and we rescued her again. And she was in tears because she thought she had made a huge mistake and no one was coming for her. But that's a success. Those are the kinds of things. And you know what? I was able to call that police chief in Kolkata and say, remember that girl you said was impossible? We just re-rescued her. I'll tell you, he was speechless. The whole department couldn't believe it. We brought her back 2 days later to Kolkata, where she testified against the original traffickers. They were counting on her not being there, and that's part of the reason they did that, because the trial was just starting, and she testified against them, and they got sentenced to 10 years hard labor. And that's a success. You talk about successes and failures. That was both. We brought her back to Kolkata, and after she testified, we set her down. We began to talk to her again about everything and help her heal and ask her, well, what's next? And so we began to give her some trauma-focused counseling again, and she grew, and she got healthy again. And you know, the interesting thing is she finally fully realized that she had made a mistake and that now her life is never, ever again going to go down that path. So she was now committed to making her life count for something. And so from there, she went on. We got her in school. We got her some other help. And she's been in school ever since. And she graduated high school. And then she turned 18. And she was preparing to go to college. I went to visit her on her 18th birthday. I brought her a gift, a really nice pen for her schoolwork. And you could tell she was just a changed creature. She was looking forward to going to college, so that she could learn how to help other girls realize the truth and realize that there's a way out. That's the effect of this work, is seeing someone like that change and grow. That's what we get to do. It's phenomenal.
Wow. That's an amazing story. What is it? How do you personally and as a team muster the will in the face of kind of this many millions of people
to
chase that one and not let that go?
Well, that's a good question. I tell you that we believe that it's worth it. Yeah, we're not going to get them all. We're not going to end slavery in our lifetime. But we just personally believe we're going to fight as hard as we can, as long as we can, and rescue as many as we can, because we think the fight, the battle, is worth it. And knowing that maybe we can't get them all. But you know what? We all have our faith, and we just believe that it's not our responsibility to get them all and then we win. Our responsibility is to be faithful. It's to do the work. It's to be present. It's to show up, and it's to not give up, and it's to give it our best. And when we do that, we just see these impossible things that so many people see are impossible. We see them become possible. And for us, that's worth it.
This is Life and Faith, and Natasha and I are speaking with Investigator V. He's a former Marine, Highway Patrolman, Special Agent, and now undercover investigator working to rescue kids from trafficking and slavery and bring their abusers to justice. You mentioned the prosecution, because this is part of what you do, isn't it?
Yes.
IJM is about finding these terrible situations, but then prosecuting the people who are responsible.
Yes, and in many of the countries where we operate, you know, they have some good laws on the books. Many of them just are not enforced, or they don't know how to prosecute them. And so we spend a lot of time actually just training prosecutors, training magistrates, training judges. When I went to Kolkata in late 2007, they had anti-trafficking laws on the books for 10 years, and they had not had a single conviction for it. It took us a year and a half, and many prosecutors didn't feel we would ever get a conviction. It's just too hard of a law to understand, to do. They just didn't believe it. So in a year and a half later, we got our first conviction, or the courts did, with our help, teaching them how to prepare witnesses, how to present evidence. And so that sent shockwaves again through the legal justice community around Kolkata. It was in all the news, front page of the newspapers, a conviction. I think that conviction, the trafficker got 9 years hard labor. And that was in 2010. From 2010 till now, we've had almost 50 convictions. And so you can see the change that takes place. Once we show them, you can do it. You can fight slavery. You don't have to accept it. A lot of that is just convincing prosecutors and judges how to handle evidence, how to hear testimony, and how to make decisions.
So, you know, we're not using your real name in this interview because you do kind of undercover work.
Yeah.
What does that mean that it's undercover, what you're doing?
Well, basically, a lot of this work, the only way it can be done is by infiltrating some of these criminal elements and criminal environments. We did work with finding slave boys on Lake Volta in Ghana, largest man-made lake in the world. Much of it is driven by slave labor of children. The only way for us to go down and find that out is to have some kind of system where we can talk with the slave masters and not say, we're here to check on slave boys, because we'd get shut down, we'd never find what we wanted to. So we developed an undercover plan. We developed a business that we could, as an international seafood market cafe. So we could go down, we could act like we're gonna make money together, and we could actually talk to this slave master about making money while my colleague is talking to the slave boy to determine his true status. You know, we don't want to go and rescue a little boy that's out fishing with his father and mother on a boat. You know, we need to find out these things. So the only way you can do that is to do it in an undercover capacity. If I walk into a brothel in Sanagachi and I say, do you have any minors for sale? They're going to say, no, get out of here, or they're going to beat me up, or they're going to call the police, because they just don't operate that way. If they see you and say, oh, I've seen him here before, he's a good customer, tell them about the girls we got. So it's important to kind of be able to walk this walk and talk this talk. You have to go into this darkness. You have to go into this evil. But it's not going to let you in if you're there to fight it. It's only going to let you in if you're there for some supposedly nefarious reason. That's on the nature of undercover work. And it's really challenging. It's really hard for investigators because they have to have this mindset on one hand. They have to walk, talk, and act like they're there to have sex with a young girl. At the same time, they have to actually not be that. They have to be thinking about strategy and safety and danger and risk, gather facts, gather information, articulate them, remember them, It's very, very hard and very challenging, but that's kind of like the dual world that undercover work is about. It's not for everyone.
How do you maintain that separation?
We talk a lot. We share a lot. It's very difficult. If you don't process things well, you should not do this work, because I've had a long enough career in law enforcement to see friends who have turned into alcoholics, who have been suicidal, who have beat their spouses and children, all because they haven't processed trauma or they haven't talked it out in some way. And so we spend a lot of time together as a small, intimate team, building space that we're safe in, that we can talk about things, that I can share with my teammate. Hey, see that girl? Remember that girl that was in there? Yeah, man, that was an ugly sight, and it just bugs me. We have to build that in. It's not going to come naturally, that kind of trust and confidence. So our team spends a lot of time debriefing, briefing, talking about things, and that only happens when you trust each other. That's the best we can do.
How dangerous is the work that you do?
It is dangerous. I'm not going to lie to you. There is a risk involved, but we don't throw caution to the wind and go charging in there. We spend a lot of time planning and preparing. We spend a lot of time thinking through contingency plans. If this goes wrong, what can we do? If that goes wrong, what can we do? What can we do to mitigate this situation? We don't get to carry guns. You know, we don't have undercover wires because they're illegal in most of the countries. So we have to try and mitigate these things. And they are dangerous and risky, but at some point in time, we have to go there. You have to. You know, I keep using this terminology, light and darkness. In a dark room, light just doesn't appear on its own. The only way to infiltrate these organizations at some point is to go there. And there's risks. So we plan as good as we can. We pray with each other. And we build contingency plans in place that are very good and very thoughtful, and then we go. And sometimes it costs us something. Sometimes we get hurt. Sometimes things happen. And then we try and debrief and figure it out and make sure it doesn't happen again. But there's a cost to it. There's a risk to it. At the end of the day, it's worth the risk.
You must have seen a lot of awful things as a police officer back in the States, but has this work shown you some very confronting things? And what's that done for you as a person and your sense of human cruelty?
It's completely changed my worldview in a lot of ways. I did see a lot as a police officer and as an undercover drug investigator. You see a lot of life destroyed. But I tell you, I thought I was prepared for this work, but I really wasn't. It was a process of learning how to deal with it. I don't think there's anything that can prepare you for a little girl being raped every day, or a young boy that's been enslaved and starving to death, and stand in front of him and do undercover work and act like you're there for nefarious purposes. I don't know what preparation would prepare you for that, but you learn as you go. And so it's been difficult. My 3 years in India, hardest 3 years of my life, of all the things I've done, including being in the Marines, but it's 3 years that I wouldn't trade for anything. You couldn't have paid me $1 million a year to do something different, honestly.
Well, you mentioned faith.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what your answer is to people if they ask, well, where's God in all this sort of horror?
Yeah. I think God is in the midst of all of it. I think God is using people to address it. If you believe in God at all, then you have to believe that God could just come down and speak it away, like he created the earth. But for some reason, God decides to use people to address it. And so I feel very strongly that God is behind it. We plan very well. We build contingency plans. We do everything we can. But at the end of the day, we feel God calls us to go into this darkness. We should bring light into that darkness. We feel that there's a purpose to it. You know, and who am I to have all this experience in life, all this knowledge, to have my health, to have my family, to have an income, and yet not do this kind of work? The joy and the purpose that's behind it, I'd be missing out on the greatest thing there is, honestly. That's what my faith does for me. And there's a joy and there's a hope behind it. You know, rescuing one of these girls or a little boy out of slavery, the rescue itself is phenomenal by any stretch. It means something very real. But the other side of it is all those who haven't yet rescued, and there are many. But you know, in doing this work, many of those have heard the work. They heard someone's out there. And just knowing, just seeing that light gives them hope. And some of them, that's actually sustaining them. They're actually saying, well, I'm not going to kill myself because maybe they will come for me. And I think that's a big part of what we're doing, is we're doing the work of the rescue, but we're also eventually getting the word out that we're going to come for you.
What's your sense of the perpetrators in all this? You know, it's easy for us to go, well, these are just evil people.
Yeah.
But from all the things you've seen, you know, in this work, why do people do this kind of thing to each other?
That's a great question. I think that there are many people out there, this is my personal opinion, there are many people out there who are fooled by evil, who are brought into this, that care more about money, more about possessions, more about pleasure than they do about people. And that's they're just misguided passion and love, that, you know, these things. And I feel sorry for them because they're headed to, in my opinion, a destiny that's very, very bad. And they're missing out on the best there is of life. I truly believe that passion for other people is just far bigger and better than we let it on to be. And so those people are fooled. That's sad. Well, you know, when a trafficker traffics a little girl and we rescue the girl and arrest the trafficker, it's not just the little girl's life who's destroyed. The trafficker's life is destroyed as well. And to spend 10 years at hard labor in an Indian prison is going to destroy you as a person. And in a certain sense, yeah, that's justice. But also thinking about it on the long-term worldview concept of that life is also destroyed as well. So in a certain sense, we feel sorry for these people because they bought into a lie. They've been fooled and they've been tricked and it's costing them their lives.
Is it important for you personally to continue to see the humanity in those people?
It's important to try. And it's easy to think of them as evil people and they got what they deserve and forget about them. But I don't think that's the truth. I think deep down inside, I think some people can be redeemed. Maybe not all of them, but I think maybe, because let's face it, there's a lot of people that have grown up and not grown up well. And so they naturally gravitate, I'm going to get mine, I'm going to take care of myself, I'm going to win. Because love is a hard thing to find in this world sometimes. Some of these girls we rescued were sold by their own families into this and told every day that they're not loved, that no one's coming for them, that no man's going to want to marry them. And so they're just told this constantly and they begin to believe it and break down. And then we come in and try and rescue them and try and get them to heal. You just got to keep in mind that people don't have all the answers that we have. They don't have all the experience that we have. They don't have loving families that we have. And I try and keep that in mind. I even as a police officer, I taught my drug investigators, when we arrest a criminal, let's at least treat him professionally. You know, we don't have to call him names. We don't have to degrade him. Because deep down inside of that evil outer shell, there's a person there. And I'd like to try, as hard as that is, to maybe redeem them someday too.
What's it done to you personally? And you said it affected your worldview. Has it affected your sense of the character of God, that this type of dreadful degradation occurs? Has that, or at least challenged you?
It did in the beginning. Because in the beginning, when you go to these places and you stand in the presence of this kind of evil, I mean, kind of my go-to thought was, what is God thinking? What is he doing? In Sonogatchi, there's 6,000 to 10,000 young women. God, how could you let this happen? So there is that process. And then you realize, well, wait, I'm here. I'm standing here. God has called me here. So the reality is that it's in our world. You can ignore it or you can choose to be a part of solving it. And that's kind of how it's changed my worldview, is that God has me here for a purpose, and it's not to retire and play golf and have fun, which sounds very inviting, and I'm not against that, but I tell you what, being involved in this work has been so good. It's dark, it's evil, it's ugly, it's costly, but the joy and the purpose that comes from it is just hard to describe.
This has been Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart, and Natasha and I were speaking with Investigator V. Now, this was a deeply moving conversation for both of us. And if it grabbed you as well, then why not go and find out about IJM, International Justice Mission, and how you can support their quest to end slavery. Go to ijm.org.au.
Do take a moment as well to share this episode with people you think would want to hear V's story. You can catch up on previous conversations from Life and Faith on our website, publicchristianity.org. And if you don't get our fortnightly newsletter, you can sign up for that on our site as well, so that you don't miss any of the stuff that we do.
Next week.
The idea that somehow the death of a child can make a mother of you. That there can be a death and rebirth. I've lost a child, not as old as that, but at birth, in a stillbirth. And so there's a part of me that can resonate with what it's like to lose a daughter, and how that experience can be a transformative experience that's painful, but transformative, and hopeful.